Hello, and welcome to the Science Podcast for December 12th, 2008. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, bringing elephants into zoos profoundly reduces their lifespan, glitches in big science projects, and reconciling financial models with human behavior. All this and more, plus a roundup of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
Elephants range over hundreds of square kilometers in the wild. But in captivity, elephants often have less than a single square kilometer of room. They spend time indoors and are often chained up at night. And that captive life, it turns out, affects how long they live, according to a paper in this week's Science. Georgia Mason and colleagues report that female elephants in European zoos live only about half as long as those living in protected areas in Africa and Asia. Compiling survivorship data on more than 4,500 elephants, or about half the global zoo population, the findings suggest that the elephants suffer from mental and physical ailments as a result of their captivity. I spoke with Mason from Ontario, Canada, where she is a zoologist at the University of Guelph.
Well, there's long been concerns about the health and welfare of elephants in zoos. There's about 1,200 of them kept in Western zoos, and problems like lameness, infanticide, and abnormal stereotypic behavior have been reported as quite common. There have been suggestions that zoo elephants have short lifespans compared with the wild. And furthermore, at least in the US, the populations consume rather than produce elephants, so the populations aren't self-sustaining. So we decided that we needed to objectively assess whether their survival was compromised in zoos compared with populations in Africa and Asia. So we focused on Europe, which holds about half the zoo elephants of the world, and we compared their lifespans with protected populations in Kenya and working animals in Myanmar or Burma.
Well, how do lifespans compare between elephants in captivity and those in these protected populations?
Well, in the African elephants, zoo animals die earlier in adulthood than they do in Amboseli National Park. In zoos, they're much less likely to make it into their 30s, 40s, and it seems as though none have made it into their 50s so far. But there were some signs of good news for this species, so it looks as though their lifespans actually improved in recent years, suggesting that husbandry has somehow improved. For Asian elephants, however, which are the most endangered of the two species, the results were pretty clear-cut and much more worrying. In this species, we found that captive-bred animals in zoos, and these are the ones that are obviously essential for a sustainable future, have half the median lifespan of captive-bred animals working in timber camps in Myanmar. So if we look at female elephants in European zoos, 50% of them are dead by the age of 19. And in Myanmar, the same figure is 42 years. So they're living around half as long as we'd expect them to.
Why did you focus in particular on female statistics?
We focused on females for a couple of reasons. There was a pragmatic reason that the sample sizes are far higher. About 80% of the zoo population is female. And it's females that are crucial for population viability. You don't need that many males to produce infants, whereas you do need a lot of females.
What additional stresses do elephants in captivity face compared to those in these protected populations?
Well, amazingly, there haven't really been studies of what matters in terms of the welfare of zoo elephants, but there are quite a lot of smoking guns. So we can see that the space they have to range in is much smaller. So the typical natural range size in Africa or Asia is tens or even hundreds of square kilometers. The typical zoo enclosure, in contrast, is a few thousand meters. So they're typically not even 1 kilometer squared. Now, we don't know if that matters, but it's possible. Elephants in zoos are often kept indoors overnight. They're sometimes even chained. In the wild, they spend about two-thirds or more of their time foraging. In zoos, it only takes a third of their time, so they've got a lot of spare time. And then there's some social factors, which are probably the more worrying. The group size in nature is typically 4 to 12 related animals. They live in matriarchal herds of related females. And in zoos, in contrast, the group sizes are much smaller. They're typically 2 to 4. Sometimes animals are even kept by themselves, and the females are typically unrelated. Groups in natural situations are also stable, so a family will stay together pretty much forever. Whereas in zoos, particularly in Asian elephants, animals are fairly regularly transferred between zoos. So for an Asian elephant in a European zoo, she'll be moved on average once every 7 years. And certainly our data show that this transfer does put animals' lives at risk. So in the Asian elephants in zoos, after each transfer to another zoo, she'll have an elevated risk of dying over the next 4 years.
Now, you said this data came from Europe, and you also mentioned that American zoos do not have self-sustaining populations.
Yeah.
Does this study have implications then for all elephants in captivity, or are we still limited by the data that your team collected thus far?
Well, we suspect this study has implications for all zoo elephants. After all, the data set comprise about 50% of the zoo population worldwide. As far as we can see from the studies that have come out of America, European zoo elephants are doing similarly, or perhaps even better. Just to give you one example, infant mortality rates for the African elephants in Europe are about 15%, so about 15% die before the age of one. And in contrast, that figure in the States is 40%. In a way, that's very worrying, but in a way, it also suggests there are husbandry differences, which, if we can find out what they are, then we can hopefully solve the problem. I should say we've also got some work currently under review in which we analyze the population viability of the European elephants. And again, they're not self-sustaining. So it looks as though the whole global zoo population of elephants is non-self-sustaining without importation.
Given those stressors on elephants in captivity of smaller range sizes, being kept indoors, the spare time, not foraging, and the social factors, as well as the transfer between zoos, what, if any, implications does this have for other zoo animals?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Well, first of all, I should say the list of potential stressors you just gave me, that's just a list of potential stressors. The only one we're pretty certain of so far is the transfer rate one. We know that in carnivores, naturally wide-ranging species are more prone to welfare problems in zoos. So species like polar bears, which naturally have huge home ranges, are much more prone to abnormal behavior and high infant mortality in zoos. I think another implication is, well, there's a couple of important implications, actually. One of our more amazing results was that in the Asian elephants, animals that are born and bred in zoos have much shorter lifespans than animals that have been imported from the wild. And this is incredibly counterintuitive. You'd sort of expect that animals that have been effectively kidnapped, you might expect them to be more stressed, more scared by people, more frustrated at the lack of natural behaviors. But instead, they seem to live a reasonably long lifespan, at least in Asians. The wild caught animals were coming into zoos at an average age of 3 or 4, which is infancy. So something's happening before the age of 3 or 4, or perhaps even prenatally, to program zoo-bred elephants to die prematurely in adulthood. And we think this is a pretty amazing result, and it would be extremely interesting to see if that's going on in other species as well. We certainly know that in one of the rhinoceros species, the white rhinoceros in zoos, captive-bred females have terrible breeding success. So females brought in from the wild breed fine. Their captive bred offspring are effectively infertile. So there's clearly some effects of early experience to do with the captive life that really need understanding now.
Well, what would it take then to fix the problem? Is it just more money or better husbandry or what?
Well, better husbandry for sure. We suggest stopping transfers until it's understood how to stop their harmful effects. We suggest leaving animals longer with their mothers because that looks as though it's a possible risk factor. It's a terrible cliche for scientists to say this, but we think more research is needed. Currently, there's hardly any research into what elephants need for good health and welfare. And in contrast, hundreds of millions are spent on new enclosures, which, you know, it's hoped will improve their welfare, but there's no way of knowing ahead of time. So in the last 10 years, Western zoos have spent or committed something like $500 million to improve the enclosures of just over 200 individual elephants. And all of this is evidence-free, essentially. And these sums are worrying because they're so staggering compared with what it would take to conserve these animals better in Africa and Asia. Just to give you one example, the Oklahoma City Zoo has recently announced plans to create a $23 million enclosure that would keep a handful of elephants. And maybe they'll be supplying elephants with what they need. You know, my fingers are tightly crossed that this will work. But they don't know it'll work. They won't monitor whether it'll work. And that sum is approximately the annual budget of something like the Kenya Wildlife Service or the South African National Parks Authority. So we're talking big sums relative to what's spent in Africa or indeed Asia.
Well, Georgia Mason, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Georgia Mason is senior author of a paper on the compromised survivorship in zoo elephants. Read the paper in this week's Science. There's been an abundance of bad news this week for big science projects in physics. Here with more about it is Science Deputy Editor Barbara Jasny.
Officials at CERN, the European Organization for Nuclear Research, issued a report about the failure of the Large Hadron Collider. The collider, LHC for short, which is supposed to reveal fundamental secrets of particle physics, had a meltdown a mere 9 days after its first run in September. It will take at least until next July to fix the problems, the report says. Some physicists are even suggesting that the meltdown indicates design flaws in the LHC's superconducting magnets that cannot be entirely eliminated. From investigations of the submicroscopic, we turn to glitches in space exploration. Technical problems in motors are bedeviling the Mars Science Laboratory. As a result, NASA officials announced that they will delay deployment of the lab for at least 2 more years. This will add significantly to the costs for a project that was already 15% over budget. According to NASA Mars Exploration Director Doug McQuestion, the total price tag may be as much as $2.3 billion. The extra money may be pulled from other projects involving Mars and possibly other planets. For more information, see the news articles by Adrian Cho and Andrew Lawler in this week's issue of Science Magazine.
That was Deputy Editor Barbara Jasny with a policy update from Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress. Also this week in Science, predicting megathrust earthquakes. Carrie C.A. and colleagues report in a paper their prediction that the eastern Indian Ocean may be due for another major earthquake in the next couple of decades. The team made the prediction based on 700 years of data from shallow coral reefs near West Sumatra. The corals have annual growth rings that record environmental change over time, like trees, and so reflect the lowering and raising of the sea level caused by the earthquakes. The last major earthquake there, in September 2007, fits with the three past earthquake episodes that occurred about every 200 years. And because each of those episodes lasted from a few decades to a little over a century, the authors suggest the 2007 quake may be the initial event in the next set of many large earthquakes to come. Read all about the earthquake supercycles in this week's Science. One of the many things getting blamed for the current financial crisis is the quantitative financial models investment firms use to make decisions. In this week's Science, freelancer Chelsea Wald reports on the development of new adaptive financial models that may help regulators take steps to lessen the impact of future financial crises. I spoke with Wald from her home office in New York City.
While this crisis, financial crisis, has been very distressing, one of the most distressing things about it has been that the experts seem to be very confused about what's going on. And one of the reasons is that the theories that they use don't take into account human behavior, and human behavior has been a major factor in this crisis. And what I looked into are some of the alternative approaches to theoretical models that do take into account human behavior.
Is there any consensus about the particular quantitative models that failed in staving off the current economic crisis?
Well, there's two kinds, roughly speaking, two kinds of quantitative models on Wall Street. One kind tries to forecast future states of the world generally, and the other one tries to forecast the behavior of a particular financial instrument given the state of the world as it is. Think stocks or currencies, and those held up okay. What really failed were the models that are trying to forecast the future of the world, and those really failed to foresee the financial crisis on the horizon.
Is that failure of this type of model going to make financial managers leery of trusting these models again?
Well, actually, it is going to make them leery, and they're going to back off of these models and use a bit more judgment in the future. But they can't really get away from the models altogether because there's far too much money to be made using quantitative models on Wall Street. So what the managers really need to know better is where these models are going to fail and when they're going to fail. And academics are building theoretical models about how markets work that will perhaps allow the managers to better contextualize their models.
What are some of the characteristics of these academic financial models?
So some of the new models that I look at in the story take into account human psychology, sociology, and one new model in particular is called the adaptive market hypothesis, as opposed to the efficient market hypothesis. So adaptive versus efficient. And the efficient market hypothesis is what everyone thinks of when they think of markets. Everyone assumes that people act rationally, that the market reflects all new information as it comes in. But the adaptive market hypothesis is very different. It assumes that markets evolve and that the players in the markets evolve quite like in evolutionary biology. So the different players in the markets aren't always doing the most efficient or the very best thing at the moment. They're just doing what they have learned through trial and error works for them. So instead of seeing market players as computers, which can always calculate the best way to achieve their goals, which is what the efficient market hypothesis does, the adaptive market hypothesis sees them as species, which evolve strategies to compete for limited profits through trial and error.
So what might this adaptive market hypothesis better be able to predict?
One thing that behavioral models can do better is explain stock market bubbles. And in the adaptive market hypothesis, when things go well and people make money, as they did for the past decade, the experience stimulates investors' reward circuitry in their brains. And this causes them to seek more profits and ignore risk. And that can lead to a bubble. And then when things take a turn for the worse, they panic and it overrides their rational decision-making abilities. And that leads to a crash. And so maybe these will help market participants and regulators see bubbles and crashes coming before they actually happen and maybe do something about it.
I suppose anything published in the academic literature and therefore subject to peer review would be immediately useless to the Wall Street traders.
Yes, it would be. The models on Wall Street exploit tiny insights that no one else has, and anything published in the academic literature would be available to anyone on Wall Street, so no one would even bother trying to build them into a model.
So is the idea then for governments, regulators to use perhaps these academic adaptive models so that they can predict these financial meltdowns or bubbles and regulate in advance of the market?
Well, maybe. Regulators should be able to use these models to stay ahead of the evolution of the market and create interventions to lessen the impact and maybe even the frequency of bubbles and crashes. But the lesson of human psychology is that human behavior is really, really complex, and we'll never really be able to stop the behaviors that cause bubbles and crashes in the market, because when it comes to money, people will always be just a little bit crazy.
Chelsea Wald, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chelsea Wald writes about new adaptive financial models that take into account human behavior. Read her article in this week's Science. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, joins us to talk about the latest science news. Hi, David.
Hey, Rob.
So what stories do you have for us today?
Well, Rob, we're going to be talking about how dogs have a sense of fairness, the dark side of tiger conservation, and finally, the link between volcanoes and earthquakes.
Well, let's start with dogs' sense of fairness. I suppose this is like equal pay for equal work with people?
Right. That's the example in people. When we think of fairness, especially in the workplace, we think about equal pay for equal work. But humans aren't the only species with a sense of fairness. Researchers have shown that other primates, notably monkeys, also have a sense of fairness. If monkeys are trained to do a specific task and they're paired with a monkey that's trained to do the same task, but they see that the other monkey is getting a reward for that task and they are not, they'll very quickly stop doing that task. And researchers have suggested that that shows that even non-humans have this sense of, hey, I'm not going to do a job if I'm not getting paid for it and if my comrade is getting paid for it.
So these researchers did a similar experiment experiment with dogs?
Right. They wanted to see, does this sense of fairness extend beyond primates? And they looked at domestic dogs. And the reason they looked at dogs is because the sense of fairness seems to have evolved from this need for social cooperation. The idea is that humans evolved fairness because early on we had to be in these very tight social groups. And if people didn't act fair, then the groups wouldn't get along. They would splinter and that would be the end of the human species.
And dogs travel in packs and chimpanzees have similar groups.
Exactly. They said, well, because dogs also seem to be cooperative or live in these cooperative societies, maybe they also have a sense of fairness. And they took 29 domestic dogs, all different breeds, and all these dogs were trained to do a trick called giving the paw. And this is basically where a person holds their hand out, the dog sees the hand and puts their paw in that person's hand.
Like a handshake.
Like a handshake, exactly. And they did an experiment similar to what they did with monkeys. And they found that just like monkeys, if one dog was rewarded for shaking hands and the other dog wasn't, the dog that wasn't and who saw the other dog being rewarded would stop shaking hands. They did the shaking hand test about 30 times in a row. And what they found was for the first 20 times, the unrewarded dog would continue shaking hands, although he would gradually grow more frustrated. He would ignore the researcher more and more often as the test went on. But after about 20 attempts, the dog would completely stop participating.
So the dog was cooperative for 20 times, but then said, that's enough.
Exactly. He said, enough's enough. This is clearly unfair, or at least that's the implication when they saw that the other dog was getting rewarded for doing the same task.
Now, at least in human society, fairness is loaded with all kinds of connotations. Are we talking about the same kind of fairness here, or is this more just sort of a limited version of fairness?
Well, it's difficult to tell because obviously we don't know what's actually going on in the dog's head.
I suppose if this was done in human trials, a real test of fairness would be if you and I were trained to do the same task, Dave, and I was getting treats, and I decided to stop doing the task because you weren't getting treats. That would be a sense of human fairness.
Exactly. And it's too early to tell whether a dog's sense of fairness is that highly developed. And it's going to take a lot more tests with dogs and other animals to really find out.
Well, from the fairness in dogs to the fairness of tiger conservation, local people help conserve tigers. Tiger population rebounds. Tigers kill people? Is that the dark side?
That is the dark side. This story has to do with the dwindling population of tigers in the world. You know, up until about a century ago, there were about 100,000 tigers in the world. Now there's only 5,000 tigers in the wild, and their range has really shrunk. It's only about 7% of what it was before. So you've got, first of all, very few tigers, but also the few tigers that are left are squeezed into these really small ranges. And so what a lot of conservation groups have tried to do is they've tried to expand the tiger ranges. They found the areas, say, of a forest where the tigers have been pushed into, and they've tried to expand the boundaries of those areas by establishing what's known as buffer zones, which are basically an expansion of the park by setting aside more land on the edges of the park so the tigers have more room to roam.
I suppose that means that tigers will roam there, and so will people?
Well, that's what researchers found. In order to establish these buffer zones, the locals in that area have to be good stewards of the land. They are asked to, say, take their cattle off the land so the cattle don't overgraze, so that the land is in good, healthy shape for the tigers to roam. And in return, the locals are subsidized for their work. But as you said, Rob, the locals also seem to be paying a price for this conservation. Researchers conducted a study of one of these buffer zone parks that's known as the Royal Chitwan National Park, and this is on Nepal's southern border with India. And what they did was they surveyed 88 fatal tiger attacks over a period from 1979 to 2006. And the park buffer zone itself was established in 1996, so the survey covered about 10 years after the buffer zone had been established. And what they found was that before the buffer zone was established, there was about one or two people killed by tigers every year. But after the buffer zone was established, this rate jumped to about 7 people per year killed by tigers.
What's that done for how the local population view the conservation of tigers?
Well, it's been really problematic because obviously this is good news for tigers. It suggests that tiger numbers may be rebounding because there's more tigers, unfortunately, to attack people. And tigers are using these buffer zones and unfortunately killing people in these buffer zones. But for the locals, it's a real problem because there was already this uneasy relationship between the locals and the tigers because of the attacks even before the buffer zone. And now when more locals are getting attacked, they're more likely to hunt the tigers or try to poison the tigers, which is obviously has the exact opposite effect that these conservationists are trying to enact.
Well, you say these rates really rose. Are there any confounding factors to the numbers jumping from one attack per year to seven attacks per year?
Well, one expert points out that the authors didn't look at any possible rise in the population of the locals. And his suggestion is there may be more people getting killed in this area because there are just more people to kill.
So the percentage of people killed may not have risen at all.
That's one possibility.
Well, from the growing rates of death by a tiger attack in Nepal to the growing connection between earthquakes and volcanoes. Tell us about this link.
Well, Rob, it makes intuitive sense that there would be a link between earthquakes and volcanoes. After all, earthquakes occur along these very sensitive seismic zones in the Earth, and they have the energy of millions of nuclear bombs, especially the really powerful earthquakes. And you can imagine with so much energy, you're really stirring the pot, as it were, of all the magma beneath Earth's surface. So even Darwin speculated in 1835 that there must be some sort of link between earthquakes and volcanoes. In other words, when there was an earthquake, it must somehow lead to an uptick in volcanic activity. But people really haven't analyzed all these historical records of earthquakes and tried to link them to volcanic activity until now.
So how often does it happen?
Well, in this current study, a team of researchers looked at a link between a couple of big earthquakes in southern Chile, one that happened in 1906 and one that happened in 1960. And this 1960 earthquake was the largest earthquake ever recorded. And what's interesting about this area is there is about 15 volcanoes that are not too far from the epicenter of these quakes. In fact, the furthest volcano is about 1,000 kilometers away. And what they did was they looked back at all the historical records, and they found that in the year following these quakes, volcanic activity from these volcanoes rose fourfold. So in an average year, you would have maybe one eruption from these 15 volcanoes. But following these earthquakes, from these 15 volcanoes, you had four eruptions. So this is really the strongest evidence yet that there's a direct link between earthquake activity and volcanic activity.
I suppose such places like Japan, where there's lots of earthquakes and lots of volcanoes, might be a place to look further for more evidence on this.
Well, the researchers are especially concerned about Indonesia. As you know, Indonesia had this massive earthquake in 2004, and they've had another couple of major earthquakes since then, one in 2005 and another one in 2007. And in Sumatra, there's 36 active volcanoes. So scientists, you know, looking at this link really want to look specifically at this area to see if the link holds. And it's also troubling for people in these regions that are very earthquake prone and that have volcanoes also, because not only do they have to worry about earthquakes, now they really have to worry about volcanic activity as well.
Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now?
Well, Rob, we're looking into stories about new advances in CD protection technology. And this is ways that researchers can help the recording industry tell the difference between a bootleg CD, say, and an original CD. We're looking into a story about how a mutation may help protect the heart from a high-fat diet. And also a story about why intelligent men are more appealing to women from an evolutionary perspective. So be sure to check out the site. And there you'll also see our new policy blog. And we're following a lot of exciting developments in the world of science policy. We've got a story about the ongoing battle between the Environmental Protection Agency and the Bush administration, UK laws about animal-human hybrids, and finally, what Obama thinks about quarks. That's all on the science policy site, Science Insider, and you'll find a link on the Science Now homepage.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can catch up on the latest science news, plus the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the December 12th, 2008 Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.